This is one of a series of tape slide talks on electroluminescence and semiconductor lasers recorded May 11, 1966 at the Stevens Institute of Technology, Hoboken, New Jersey. The seminar was organized by Gerald J. Herskowitz, Carl Connerth, and Elliot Schlamm of the Basic Sciences Committee of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, New York Section. A recorded voice interspersed with the speaker will give numbers corresponding to the numbered slides accompanying this recording. Begin by projecting slide one, the title, now. This first talk is Introduction to Luminescence and Semiconductor Lasers, presented by Dr. Henry F. Ivey, Westinghouse Research Laboratories, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Slide two.
Well, my talk is a general introduction to today's seminar, so I will be speaking mainly in generalities and will leave most of the details to the following speakers. And it may well be that they will have recent up-to-date information which makes some of the things that I say out of date. This will be interesting to see. By luminescence, we mean the emission of visible or near-visible, that is, infrared or ultraviolet radiation, as a result of electronic stimulation of a material, excluding any emission due to the temperature of the material. Today we will be talking about three types of luminescence, three types of excitation: electroluminescence, in which we excite the material with an electric field or by passing a current through it; cathodoluminescence, in which we excite the material by bombarding it with an electron beam; and photoluminescence, in which we excite the material with radiation.
Slide three.
Now, in the first slide, we see some of the kinds of electronic transitions which we can get as a result of such stimulation. We can have transitions which involve impurities from the conduction band to acceptors, from donors to the valence band, and from donors to acceptors. We can also have transitions between the bands, and in case we have hot carriers, these can correspond to energies which are greater than the band gap. If we do have hot carriers, we can also have intra-band transitions corresponding to low energies, as shown there. Now, unfortunately, we can also have transitions which don't give us radiation. Now, let's first talk about electroluminescence, and for the moment, talk only about spontaneous incoherent emission. 2 months ago, I would have told you that electroluminescence was first observed in silicon carbide in 1923 in Russia by a man named Losev, but today I have to tell you that it was first observed in 1907 by a man named Round in New York City. This is a backward advance of 16 years. However, there was very little work done in electroluminescence until the discovery different type of excitation in 1936 by Destrio, who used zinc sulfide powders embedded in a dielectric and which were subjected to an alternating field in a capacitor type device. There was considerable work done in the past 20 years on these zinc sulfide phosphors, but unfortunately the best efficiency which could be obtained, which was of the order of 1 to 4%, was somewhat disappointing. I should mention that in addition to zinc sulfide powders, one can also make zinc sulfide films by deposition in vacuum, which will work on DC as well as AC, and also have the advantage of low voltage operation. Because of this low efficiency, such zinc sulfide electroluminescence hasn't found much application in the field of lighting, although it is of some use in display devices and other applications requiring large area light sources.
Slide four.
The next slide shows a list of other materials, which is quite extensive, in which electroluminescence has been observed. Now, in many of these cases, the emission is actually due to impurities in the material, so that if all these impurities were included, the list would be larger by another factor. Now, not all of these materials operate by the same mechanism. There are many types of electroluminescent excitation. In general, if one is to obtain high efficiency from electroluminescence, you must have several requirements met. In the first place, you must have a high quantum efficiency. That is, you must get as many quanta emitted as possible for each electron that you pass through the device. Secondly, you must minimize ohmic and other electrical losses, which have nothing to do with the light generation process. And thirdly, once you have the light generated, you must obviously get it out of the device without having it absorbed.
Slide 5.
The next slide shows perhaps the simplest type of electroluminescent excitation. In the left-hand part of the slide, we have a picture of a very oversimplified p-n junction in a semiconductor in the absence of voltage. In the center of the slide, we have the same junction with an applied voltage V. We are injecting minority carriers, both electrons into the p-type side and holes into the n-type side. And in this simple case, if we are lucky, they can recombine with the majority carriers and give us light. The other part of the same slide shows that in such a junction, one can also have another type of transition which involves tunneling of electrons and holes into the barrier with recombination there. This would be much more likely in a degenerate junction rather than the simple non-degenerate one drawn here.
Slide 6.
Perhaps the best electroluminescent material to date is gallium arsenide, and I'm sure we'll hear more about this later. But I would just like to mention that, as far as I know, the highest efficiency obtained to date in this material, this is an external quantum efficiency, the ratio of emitted quanta to electrons passing through the material, is 32% at 77 degrees Kelvin and 7% at room temperature. Now, the internal quantum efficiency in these cases is much higher than that and undoubtedly approaches 100%. Now, gallium arsenide emits in the infrared at about 0.84 microns. If one wants visible emission, there are, of course, many other semiconductors with wider band gaps that one can use. One of these is gallium phosphide. The maximum efficiency to date for gallium phosphide seems to be at about 1.5%, and this is for red emission at 0.7 microns. If one makes solid solutions of gallium arsenide, gallium phosphide, one finds that one can get reasonable efficiency with compositions which give longer wavelengths up to a limit of about 0.62 or 0.64 microns, but for shorter wavelengths, the efficiency is lower. Now, this is attributed to the fact that in gallium arsenide, the transitions are direct transitions, not requiring cooperation of phonon emission or absorption, whereas in gallium phosphide and the phosphorus-rich side of the system, the transitions are indirect. Another outstanding efficiency is that in cadmium telluride, where 12% was obtained at 77 degrees Kelvin by Mandel and Moorhead. That's at 0.78 microns. In the case of zinc telluride, zinc selenide solid solutions, Arvin obtained an efficiency of 18% at 70 degrees Kelvin. We mentioned gallium arsenide, gallium phosphide solid solutions. The next slide shows a list of other solid solutions in which electroluminescence has been studied. Now, in many cases, it's difficult to make p-n junctions in a material simply because the material doesn't want to be simultaneously n-type and p-type. One way around this is to make a heterojunction in which you use one chemical compound for the p-type side and a different chemical compound for the n-type side.
Slide 7.
The next slide shows junctions which have been made in this way and which did result in light emission. However, in all these cases, the efficiency of the radiation is very poor, apparently because the actual injection efficiency of these heterojunctions is not all one would like.
Slide 8.
It's not simple to make these heterojunctions. Now, it's not necessary to have a p-n junction to have electroluminescence. The next slide shows what can happen in the case of a metal contact to a semiconductor.
Slide 9.
An n-type semiconductor showing the inversion layer at the metal contact when the voltage is applied, holes being injected from the metal with recombination.
Slide 10.
In the next slide, we show what can happen in a p-n junction if we reverse bias it. In this case, due to the high fields in the junction, electrons can be accelerated, generate other electrons by collision. Holes can do the same thing so that we can form avalanches. And this type of emission is easily seen in reverse bias silicon or germanium junctions, for example. We can also generate electroluminescence by tunneling.
Slide 11.
The next slide shows one case of a degenerate zinc telluride p-type metal contact in the absence of voltage and the diagram which was proposed to explain the observations in this case. The emission was seen as a very narrow band corresponding almost exactly to the band gap and was explained by simultaneous tunneling of holes from the metal and of electrons from the metal and of holes across the band gap of the semiconductor and then recombination.
Slide 12.
The next slide shows another type of tunneling electroluminescence in which we have a semiconductor with two metal electrodes with very thin insulating layers between, which may be inorganic or organic. Below, with the applied voltage, we see tunneling of holes at one end, tunneling of electrons at the other, and hopefully recombination in between. This slide shows also that we can have simultaneously loss of electrons by tunneling and loss of electrons by holes. But Fisher has shown that these losses can be minimized if one uses appropriately selected semiconductors rather than metals as the contacts. Well, I think we've seen enough slides to convince ourselves that electroluminescence isn't simple, that there are many types. But unfortunately, the fact remains that today the only material which gives really high efficiency is gallium arsenide, which emits in the infrared and then really efficiently only at low temperature. If you're interested in visible emission, then you must turn to gallium phosphide or zinc sulfide or something like that, and the efficiency is not very good.
Slide 12A.
Thus far, we've been talking only about spontaneous emission, in which the individual emitting centers in the material emit independently and randomly so that the output is incoherent. Now let's talk about stimulated emission. In this case, we have emission from an excited level which is triggered by the presence of a photon of the same energy. And the emission which is triggered in this way, stimulated in this way, is in phase with the stimulating emission so that we obtain coherent output. Now, to obtain a situation in which the stimulated emission overrides absorption, we must have more of the centers in the excited state available for emission than we do in the ground or unexcited state, because they will result only in absorption of the radiation that we are interested in. In other words, we must have a population inversion in the material. If this is the case, we have optical gain. The propagation constant is positive. And if this gain exceeds other optical losses, then we can have an oscillator. In other words, we can have a laser. And that's what we will talk about now. There were several proposals made for semiconductor lasers a few years ago. Some of these involved things like cyclotron resonance and a magnetic field in a material like indium antimonide, but as yet these really don't seem to be working. The first really operating laser was achieved in 1962 by PN injection, by minority carrier injection over forward biased gallium arsenide junctions.
Slide 13.
Since that time, many other materials have shown laser action in this way, and these are shown on the next slide, together with the emission wavelengths. Now, the threshold in the case of gallium arsenide increases roughly as the cube of the temperature above some temperature of 10 or 20 degrees K. So this means that the room temperature threshold is very much higher than the low temperature threshold. As a result, although one can make continuously operating gallium arsenide lasers at liquid nitrogen temperature, this has not yet been the case at room temperature, although there is at least one paper in the literature predicting that this will be achieved by the end of 1966, and this will be interesting to see. An external quantum efficiency of 72% at 100 degrees K has been achieved in gallium arsenide. The gallium arsenide phosphide solid solution system shown there would be of interest because of the visible emission which would result, but in general, due to complications in this solid solution, the efficiency is lower and the thresholds higher than in gallium arsenide itself. Now, perhaps we should mention that in the case of lead selenide, if you apply pressure to the material, you can shift this wavelength of 8.5 microns listed there out as far as 11 experimentally, and in principle, even further.
Slide 14.
One can also lower the threshold in many of these materials by applying magnetic fields, but we won't have time to talk about these effects here. Perhaps they will be discussed in the following papers. In addition to the lasers shown on this slide, which involve PN junctions, Weiser and Woods have reported laser action in gallium arsenide from avalanche injection, which presumably requires no PN junction. Well, let's now turn to electron beam excited lasers. Now, this involves some complication because one must put the material in a vacuum. Such lasers were first proposed by Bassoff in 1961, and several people tried ruby and gallium arsenide early in the stage unsuccessfully. Actually, the first operating electron beam excited lasers were demonstrated in 1964 and involved cadmium sulfide, indium arsenide, and indium antimonide.
Slide 15.
As the next slide shows, since that time, many other materials have been added to this list, including some, such as gallium selenide, the cadmium compounds, and the element tellurium, which haven't been made into injection lasers because of the problems in making PN junctions in these materials. Now, in electron beam excited lasers, there are several factors which determine the efficiency and therefore the threshold. These include reflection or backscattering of the primary electrons from the material which you are bombarding, the penetration depth and the rate of energy dissipation of the primaries, the amount of energy which one must expend to form an electron-ion pair in the material, and absorption, optical absorption in the material, as influenced by free carrier concentration. Now, in general, as a rough rule, you can say that the energy required to form an electron hole pair in a semiconductor is roughly three times the band gap. So this means that the maximum energy efficiency that you would expect is roughly 30%.
Slide 16.
The next slide shows the effect of the carrier concentration on the calculated threshold for N-type and P-type gallium arsenide, showing that there is an optimum concentration as a result of the free carrier absorption at high carrier concentrations. In the case of cadmium selenide, which emits at 0.68 microns, Hurwitz at MIT has obtained an efficiency of 8% at 4 degrees Kelvin and 5% at liquid nitrogen temperature, and these are energy efficiencies. Remember, the figures for the injection lasers were quantum efficiencies, but now we're back to energy. This seems to be the highest efficiency to date for any visible semiconductor laser. The cadmium sulfide laser is also of interest because its emission wavelength, 0.49 microns, is the shortest for any operating semiconductor laser, if one excludes the questionable case of silicon carbide, that is.
Slide 17.
Finally, we turn to optically excited lasers, where again there were many early proposals that one should be able to excite a laser in this way. Success was achieved late in 1964 with gallium arsenide excited by a ruby laser. Since that time, as shown in the next slide, there have been several other such devices. In all these cases, it should be noted that the excitation source is itself a laser, is coherent. So that here we have one laser excited by another. For good efficiency, the emission spectrum of the exciting source must obviously match very well the absorption spectrum of the material that you were exciting, and this leads to problems in obtaining good overall efficiency. The cadmium mercury telluride system shown there is of some interest. The actual experiment was done with 32% cadmium and gave emission at 4 microns, but it was predicted that for 20% cadmium, the emission should occur at 15 microns, which would be a new long wave limit for semiconductor lasers, but this is still only a prediction. Now, we should point out two special cases there. Normally, for optical excitation, you excite a material with a shorter wavelength than the emission wavelength. But in the case of gallium arsenide pumped by a neodymium-doped glass laser and of cadmium sulfide pumped by a ruby laser, just the opposite is true. In these cases, the exciting wavelength is longer than the emission wavelength, which means that the energy of the emitted photons is greater than that of the exciting photons. And this is possible only because at these very high exciting power levels, these are Q-switched lasers, the actual excitation is by a two-photon process, so that the energy of two input photons goes into making one output photon.
Slide 18.
In conclusion, electroluminescence has been observed in a large number of materials. Laser action has also been observed in a fairly large number of semiconductors with electroluminescent, cathodoluminescent, or photoluminescent excitation. These materials are obviously useful for a variety of applications, particularly if emission in the infrared and operation at low temperature is feasible. On the other hand, efficient visible electroluminescence or coherent emission has not been observed from any semiconductor at room temperature today. Thank you. How's our time?
You have been listening to a tape slide presentation of Introduction to Luminescence and Semiconductor Lasers, presented by Dr. Henry F. Ivey of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers Basic Science Committee Seminar, May 11, 1966, at the Stevens Institute of Technology, Hoboken, New Jersey. Thank you.